Good morning. May it please the Court. Appellants are going to address two issues this morning. First, the question of whether certain communications between utility executives and commissioners created such a strong appearance of impropriety that the commissioners involved were required to recuse. And second, the question of whether the commission improperly denied an offer of proof. I'm going to address the first question raised by appellants here this morning. And this is really a simple question about basic fairness. With respect to this issue, appellants argue that the secret pre-filing meetings between utility executives and PSC commissioners created such a strong appearance of impropriety that the commissioners were required to recuse themselves. Imagine for a minute that you're an attorney for a woman in a divorce case. You're getting ready for trial, and by accident, you discover that the attorney for the husband had met with the trial judge just a few weeks earlier to present his strategy for the case and to see if the judge had any negative reaction. I expect you'd be outraged by that, and I expect you would be not mollified in the least if the husband assured you that he asked for no commitment from the trial judge and received no commitment.
Well, we don't, in the legal profession, we don't have as broad a statement as they had here. You can meet people at conventions, you can meet the whole idea, there's this dual function of the regulatory agencies, which is apparent federally and locally, of promoting the industry and also regulating the industry, both at the same time by the same group. So when they have these things, well, you can talk to anyone and anytime, anyone in the public at conventions, you know, maybe one could say the regulators are there to promote more efficient industry, and they want to know more, and it allows for informal contact between these groups.
And I think you're referring to the statutory section 386.210, and frankly, with all due respect, it does not say that the commission can meet with anyone. And in fact, I think that's one of my arguments, because if the legislature had wanted...
It's the lack of a comma.
That's part of it, yes.
It's all about the comma.
That's exactly part of it. I think if the legislature had wanted to say the commission may meet with anyone, the legislature would say the commission may meet with anyone. But instead, they said the commission may meet with members of the public, other bodies like itself at the state and federal level, and similar commissions like that.
And conventions.
But in this context,
what's the thing about it, meeting at conventions? I mean,
yes,
you have a convention of utilities, and who are you going to meet at a convention of utilities?
I think your point is the meeting here wasn't about general issues. It was about something that was about to be filed as a case, and they talked about specific issues relevant to a specific plan submission.
Right. And that's the second issue. The first issue is whether the statute actually allows this kind of meeting with utilities under the premise that members of the public encompasses utilities. And if you can get over that hurdle,
I think one of the arguments is that, of course, everybody's a member of the public. So the fact that you happen to be on a utility board doesn't make you not a public member. And I'm wondering if you're not talking to them as a member of the public, but you're talking to them at the commission as someone who's about to submit something to them. Does that affect whether we consider them a member of the public as used in the statute?
Certainly. And throughout Chapter 386, there's references to the public and there's references to the utility. And it's pretty clear that the concept of Chapter 386 is to set the members of the public apart from the utilities. And in fact, my job in Chapter 386.710, is to represent the public. No one's ever suggested that I should be representing utility executives because they're members of the public. So I think throughout 386, the public is distinct from the utilities.
That you use of the judicial code being applicable to the PSC commissioners is really misplaced. They're a member of the executive branch, and the judicial code covers the judiciary branch. In absence of any rule or policy that the PSC has adopted themselves regarding these type of ex parte communications, where are you?
Well, I think with respect to the specific provisions of the judicial canons, I don't think it's as important to say whether they apply or not word for word, but I think it's crucial that this Court understand that the principles behind the judicial canons do apply, whether it's an administrative body or a circuit court. The principles that I'm most interested here are the principles of basic fairness, which says that one party isn't allowed to go before the trier of fact, preview their case, watch for reactions, and then leave the other parties sort of hanging in the wind.
Are there specific codes or regulations, or you're adverting to just basic due process entitles you to a fair and impartial judge?
I think both the basic due process and the due process clause and the principles behind the judicial canons, and I've quoted the judicial canons, and I think the reason that they are there is to keep the judiciary, and in this case, even though it may not strictly apply, the principles apply, and administrative tribunals on the straight and narrow track to provide a fair hearing to all the parties.
But since this took place, hasn't the PSC implemented or adopted more of a code of ethics?
They have. They have changed the rule. The specific rule at issue that both respondents cite has been changed and is no longer in effect. But that sort of raises the point that the commission can change its rules at any time. And so we really need some guidance from this court as to what are the allowable parameters within which it can change its rules. So the fact that they have changed the rules since then, I think both highlights the fact that they thought that the original rule, which allowed this kind of conduct, was improper, and the fact that they could change it back at any time they want to.
Does anything address, say we were to find a violation because they're not members of the public and we didn't find it otherwise appropriate, mm-hmm. Is there anything in here that says what the remedy would be for that violation, what the effect of such a violation is, or is that?
There are the Slavin case, the Union Electric case, in which the court did find that a sitting commissioner was subject to the judicial canons to the extent that she could not participate in a case in which she had an interest, says that the proper remedy is to remove that commissioner from the case.
I mean, would you have to, or was there proof here of actual communication that affected the result? Or as a judge, there's appearance of impropriety.
Right.
It's the reason why you recuse.
Yes.
It's not clear that due process, or certainly if you look at the case the U.S. Supreme Court decided on, the West Virginia case, it didn't address appearance of impropriety. It addressed actual impropriety,
yes,
which basically was the necessary implication of giving such a gross amount of money to one person, that you couldn't have faith in the
right
independence of the decision maker at that point, even if they might have been independent.
Would
a discussion at a convention that something was going to be filed later certainly doesn't rise to that level? How do we evaluate?
Certainly, a discussion at a convention about a general filing to be happening sometime in the future would not rise to that level. But that's not what happened here. What happened here is that the utility executives set up these meetings specifically with these commissioners in a way that evades public notice under the Sunshine Law to talk not only about the fact of the merger, but about the specific regulatory mechanisms that the utilities wanted the commission to approve in order for the merger to go forward, and the utilities did that for the express purpose of judging whether the commissioners reacted negatively to those proposals. So that's a very, very different situation than talking generally about regulatory principles at a convention. And I think that's the problem here. I don't have any basis to believe that there was actual bias as a result. And in fact, I have not even alleged actual bias. But I think the appearance of impropriety is so strong that the commissioners were required to recuse themselves simply on that basis rather than on the basis of actual bias. And I have taken way more than my time, and so I'm going to yield the rest of my time to my other appellant. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'll be very brief. David Woodsmall on behalf of Praxair. I'm addressing the issue of the commission's refusal to allow an offer of proof. Some of you were with the court, the Supreme Court, when you issued the ag processing decision. We believe the Court of Appeals acted contrary to that decision. For instance, we claim that the Court of Appeals fails to understand a critical issue as it applies to the commission's balancing test. At pages 9 and 10 of its order, the Court of Appeals finds that the evidence regarding KCP&L's gift and gratuity policy and its code of conduct are wholly irrelevant as a matter of law. Citing to other cases, the court held that the commission, quote, is not permitted to dictate the manner in which the company shall conduct its business, unquote. The commission and the Court of Appeals failed to properly understand, however, the scope of the commission's merger inquiry. Appellants did not raise issues as to gift and gratuities and code of conduct for the purpose of having the commission impose that standard on the utilities. Rather, using the language of the Ag Processing Court, these issues were raised because they, quote, may have substantially impacted the weight of the evidence evaluated to approve the merger. There's a difference between imposing that standard and considering how that standard is going to be expanded in the merger analysis. At page 3, the Court of Appeals recognizes that Aquila's code of conduct was, quote, ethically superior, unquote. Therefore, evidence that Aquila would be now adopting KCP&L's ethically inferior code of conduct as a result of the merger may have and should have impacted the balancing test.
The offer of proof issue about whether or not, I mean, it's unusual for a judge not to allow an offer of proof, especially in a non-jury case. I mean, this is a non-jury case. What say you on that? I mean,
we agree. It took us flat-footed. We believe that, as I said, the commission thought that these matters were wholly irrelevant, and those are the key words, wholly irrelevant as a matter of law because they can't dictate policy. But again, we weren't trying to have a policy imposed. We were asking them, consider this when you do your balancing test. So the commission applied the wrong standard. The commission applied a standard as to we're going to tell the utility what to do when they shouldn't have been applying that standard.
But the rules do give the regulatory judge more authority, or they're differently worded. I'm trying to find it in your brief where it's set out, where it does talk about wholly irrelevant. The court can exclude. I can't find the page. Do you know what page you're on?
I know it's in. I know where you're talking. Yeah. It's in point 2 of my brief.
The point being that it talks about hearing, and it gives some authority to the regulatory judge to limit evidence that they hear. It's not clear to me here if the judge was also, if you're contending the judge also would not let you submit evidence in the record, even if you couldn't present it in open court. Courts do have some discretion, and they're not going to allow just unlimited amount of time before them to have witnesses testify in something that they feel is of marginal or no relevance. And in a regular circuit court, you'd certainly have discretion maybe to require a more limited offer of proof or offer of proof that didn't take up actual hearing time.
And you're right on target. There was no opportunity. There was a motion pre-filed to limit the scope of the hearings, and the judge ruled on that. And there was no opportunity subsequent to that to put in one word as an offer of proof.
Did you request an opportunity to offer written offer of proof? Just witnesses that
we
were
didn't
refused?
Distinguish between written or testimonial offers of proof. We asked to make, quote, an offer of proof, and we were denied.
And I'll ask opposing counsel how they interpret what the court said.
Thank you.
Excuse me, I have one more question. Your opponent argues that your offer of proof argument as being a violation of the Constitution wasn't preserved. Can you address that?
It was preserved. If you look at page 4 of my reply brief, I take on that issue directly. And if you look at point 17 from our application of rehearing, it's quoted there. We specifically say there that the denial of the offer of proof denies due process. So we raise the constitutional argument in the application for rehearing. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jennifer Heinz for the commission. I will take the appellants in order, and I will address the arguments made by Mr. Mills first, but I'd like to take his points a little bit out of order and start with the remedy that's available in this case. This is a Section 386.510 review. What the court may do at the conclusion of this case is affirm, reverse, or reverse with instructions. But the only instructions that can be given are to take some evidence that was not taken at the first time and render a new decision. So I don't think at this point the remedy, I'm sorry.
So a challenge to the appropriateness of the finder of fact is not within the scope of judicial review?
At this point, I think that is outside of what is before this court. So in other words, Mr. Mills filed a motion to dismiss. That motion to dismiss was denied. This court can't, under 386.510, send this case back to the commission with the instruction that motion to dismiss be granted, for example.
Certainly reverse if there was a biased fact finder? And I'm not suggesting here, but say you had someone who had an interest in the case. For some reason, it was a clear-cut biased fact finder. You're saying this court could not send it back to the commission? This court would have to affirm?
You could reverse. But you could not reverse and say you must grant the motion to dismiss. You must reverse and issue a new order. How exactly that would play out, who would sit on that case?
But a commission
in
regulatory scheme of things, the commission in some respects sits almost as judge. And then when they sit in their judicial function of deciding something, then we have authority over any kind of judicial function. And if there's the, I hate to use the word appearance of impropriety, but of bias or influence by, if someone had a conversation with the trial judge beforehand about the divorce, and then they bring, then they find out how the judge is going to do things, and then they bring the divorce later, you know, that certainly the judge would have to be disqualified. But in this case, you have these conversations, private conversations between utility and the commissioners, and then they rule without the public counsel there or anyone else in the public, and then they have a hearing and they rule accordingly. That somehow it doesn't pass the we used to call it a smell test. I mean, something, and we have authority over bias and especially the judicial function. When they're dealing with the judicial function, I think we have some authority over that.
I'm certainly not trying to imply that this court has to affirm the commission's order, although I would like you to. But in a reversal, the instructions that you can give along with that reversal are limited by 386.510. Now, if the court found that there were an appearance of impropriety and that an appearance of impropriety in an administrative case is enough to warrant a reversal, which I don't concede, and I can talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But if that were the case, even so, the case would have to go back to the commission, and the instructions would not be, and you, sir, and you, sir, and you, sir, may not sit on the case.
Why not?
Because that's not within what the legislature has allowed for judicial review of commission orders.
First,
now there could have been.
Now, what would happen if we were just to say those three people ought not to have sat on this case?
Mm-hmm.
The decision's reversed.
Okay. Then the case goes back to the commission.
And
the commission issues
said
a new order. But I think that instruction would be improper.
I mean, in essence, what's the difference between just saying because these people sat on the case is reversed, and saying because these people sat on the case is reversed now, you ought to try this again without these people? In the end, if you want an order that's affirmed, they can't be there. What's the difference?
I think a reversal by this court would leave, because of the issues raised in the motion to dismiss, would leave a question about what would happen once the case got back to the commission. Now, we might end up right back here.
If there was an NLRB case where there weren't enough commissioners, I think they said, well, it can't operate without enough commissioners. If you take three commissioners off because they were, quote, unquote, biased or whatever, can you act? I mean, could the commission then act? Do you have an ability to have the governor appoint other people to sit if you don't have a quorum, if you don't have enough people to go make a decision? What do you do then?
There must be a quorum under 386.130. So the commission must have three members to act. I don't know of any provision in the law that would allow the governor to appoint a, say, interim commissioner to sit and hear on a case. It's not like where, you know, if a judge is disqualified on the bench, you pull in another judge from somewhere. I don't know of any provision where that's allowed in the commission law. We've got five people in this state who can hear these kinds of cases.
So if three people are disqualified, what happens then if you only have two?
Wasn't it just two of the three?
Three commissioners voted,
okay.
And two voted in favor, one voted opposed. But the majority of the quorum can act for the body, but you must have a quorum to begin with. So there have to be three deciding votes.
And there were three commissioners that spoke with the, there were three commissioners who spoke?
There were three commissioners who sat. And
so tell me why that doesn't disqualify them from hearing the case.
I'm sorry.
Tell me why that was not disqualified.
I think we're talking at cross purposes here.
Okay.
Are you asking how many commissioners had meetings with the?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. I misunderstood. I believe that two of the commissioners who ultimately sat on the case ended up casting a vote, one for and one against.
So if they were taken off, you'd still have three commissioners?
Well, there was another commissioner who didn't have a conversation. There was no evidence of taint, but was removed because he had an affiliation with a law firm that represented one of the commissioners. So he didn't sit either.
Are they all the same people now? Are there new commissioners since then?
I think I was thinking about this the other day, and if it came back and we had to figure out who was going to hear the case, I think I counted only two.
That are still left.
That would be
that would be
able to hear the case.
There would not be a quorum unless a new commissioner were appointed.
Right.
So are the three commissioners involved still sitting on the PSC?
One is not for sure.
Another person is qualified, and that's the problem because of the firm.
Yeah. There are two commissioners who are still on the commission.
So four out of five had some issues.
Three.
Can you address the merit?
But one of them, I would have to say, and I would like to make this point,
yes,
is not because of this communication that happened in January. It's because of an affiliation with a law firm.
Yes.
So, you know, whether or not.
Do you have any doctrine of necessity? Like, for example, the Supreme Court of Missouri was sued on its IALTA regulations. The whole Supreme Court was sued, but we have a doctrine of necessity. Said, well, we're it. We'll just still decide it. Is there any doctrine of necessity, although these would be severe questions, is there any doctrine of necessity that the PSC has to be able to act?
I don't know that the rule of necessity would overcome the statutory requirement that the commission have a quorum.
Or be impartial.
Well, the commission...
Can a person be present for the purpose of having a quorum and be disqualified from voting on the case?
I think not.
But that rule might apply to the person.
I know it's a serious question.
Two different concepts.
And I'm you know, I think there have to be a majority of commissioners who are able to, or I'm sorry, a quorum of commissioners who are able to cast a vote or who are participating in the case. So I don't think a fourth commissioner could come and sit and say, yes, we're here, we're present, we have a quorum, and then abstain from the vote. Or a third, that would be a third commissioner, because if you've got three, you've got a quorum.
Don't you have commissioners abstain from votes?
Yes.
And they're part of a quorum.
A quorum is a majority of the commission. So they could sit. But
is an action by the commission taken by two of its members, even though there's a quorum,
mm-hmm,
say there's four people, or two abstain and two vote yes. Is that an act of the commission?
That I think is exactly what happened here, because you had five commissioners to begin with, two didn't participate. So there were three members who
so you only had two affirmative votes
who voted. So there were two affirmative votes, one negative vote. And the general common law rule is that a majority of a quorum is authorized to act for a body. So yes, in that case, the vote of two commissioners, there's an FCC case that says this, two of the three who sat as a quorum could act for the body.
Your time is winding down.
My time is winding well down, and Mr. Zobrist is really, I'm sure, anxious to get up here. Does the court have more questions for me?
Offer of proof. What about the offer of proof? Like we said, it's very unusual for an offer of proof to be denied. Usually the advocate's allowed to make an offer of proof and the judge can rule against them, but did not allow an offer of proof. What about that?
It is allowed. It's allowed in 536.070, and it's also allowed by the commission's own internal rules, which are adopted.
It wasn't allowed here, though. Very clearly on the record, the judge said no.
No, what's allowed, I'm sorry, what is allowed is that an a wholly irrelevant offer of proof.
Who's to decide if it's wholly irrelevant? The whole point is it's a catch-22. We can't see it to see if we agree.
How do we review it?
That's the whole idea, is you put together information. The judge wants to say it's irrelevant, that's fine, but you have it in front of them.
And I don't read the statute as prohibiting that. It says evidence, even if there's an objection to it, shall nevertheless be heard and preserved in the record even when the objection is sustained, together with any cross-examination and any rebuttal, unless it is wholly irrelevant, repetitious, privileged, or unduly long. And so one could read that as saying you're not going to allow live testimony, cross-examination, rebuttal, and so forth of things that are wholly irrelevant. It doesn't say you can't make an offer of proof, though, at least a written offer of what that would be. So we could review and see if we agree that this policy about gifts and so forth is or is not relevant to whether or not this merger would be in the interests of the
I'll let Mr. Zobris address the relevance, but just to answer your question really quickly, the record isn't great, and Mr. Wismal himself admitted that there wasn't.
Mr. Zobris knows the policy. We can ask that.
But the offer wasn't made. Right. So I think the record in this case supports the commission's decision. I'm so sorry, Mr. Zobris. Take it away.
Let me point out a very important fact that I think we glossed over in the briefs, and that is that the merger proposal that was approved by the commission was greatly revised from the original proposition that was presented to the commission. The merger proposal that was approved by the commission was submitted in February of 2008, 13 months after the pre-filing meetings that Mr. Mills is concerned with. And it's that merger proposal that has more benefits, fewer detriments, and then the commission went beyond and said, you know, you don't recover transaction costs and any credit problems that you might have as a result of this merger, those are on the shareholders. So the proposal that was approved by the commission is different from the pre-filing meetings.
Does this argument go to that you're saying, assuming we were to find it improper, there's no evidence that it had any effect on it, or it was just an appearance?
Right. That's absolutely right, Judge.
Well, actually, the purpose of the meeting, if I can be so bold as to say what the purpose was, since I wasn't there, might be to say, well, let's figure out where the commission is on this, and then we can shape our proposal so we know that we're going to propose is approved.
But that wasn't done until over a year later, Judge Wolf. Mm-hmm. You know, the commissioners were acting in their legislative capacities, I think Judge Teitelman was suggesting. This is before a filing. These meetings were perfectly proper. They occur all the time. It was a general introduction of the merger. Then it was announced publicly the next month, and then 2 months later there was a filing. And what I'm telling you is the filing that was approved for the merger didn't come along until a year later. So even if you do think that there is something inappropriate, and there was not, because they were acting as legislators, they were not acting as judges, even with that, it was a different merger proposal that had greater benefits.
And I understand that the commissioners certainly didn't think they were doing anything improper, but if the court were to tell me why it's proper to get a preview from the commissioners of how they would react to a proposal so that you can change it to make it one that they would agree to. I mean, certainly in court, you can't do that.
You can't do that in court. And they're acting as legislators. It's like going to your congressman.
No, but they're acting as judges on this particular, approving or disapproving this particular.
Right. But at the time of the meetings, Judge Stiff, they were acting as legislators.
But tell me why that's the case when you're asking them about a case that's about to be filed. So you're not asking them, how should our rules, what should the rules be, you know, if you're going to set out some regulations, things that are more legislative. You're asking them to in advance let you know what they're going to think of your case. That doesn't sound legislative.
Well, the record is very poor as to what was asked. What we have in the record shows it was purely educational. We're going to do this merger. Another company is going to be involved from outside the state to explain what was going on and to talk about perhaps some specific proposals. But there's nothing in the record that tells us what is said. But to Mr. Mills' point about the specific proposals, there were different proposals that were actually approved by the commission over a year later. And
there's nothing on the record of this private conversation.
Right, there is not. And that's why I'm saying there is nothing to show that there was any bias and prejudice. In fact, you know, one of the commissioners who was supposedly there, and in his concurrence, Commissioner Clayton says, I wasn't there, but he voted against it.
Do you read 386.210.1, the thing about may confer in person by correspondence, to authorize this communication?
Point one and point two, Judge, and also point four. And point four of 386.210 talks about members of the public and any person. And persons are defined in Chapter 386 to include electrical corporations. So there's clearly nothing in 386.210 that prohibited this meeting.
Can you answer the question that was asked earlier about why, if it's anybody can talk to them about anything, why separate out the reference to members of the public from reference to members of utility commissions and so forth?
I think you have to read 386.210.1 where it has those, with point four that says nothing here is to basically have a chilling effect on communications with any persons about any matter that is not
related
pending.
To matters of general regulatory policy and do not address the merits of the specific facts, evidence, claims, or positions taken or presented in a pending case.
Right, in a pending case. And this was not a pending case. It was 2 months before a pending case. On the offer of proof issue, well, let me one more thing. The rule of necessity would require the court, if it does find that there's something wrong here, to go ahead and, as it did in the Fitzgerald case that the commission cites in her brief, you would have to go ahead and decide this case because only Commissioner Jarrett was the one that is not affected by this motion. You have Commissioner Clayton, who says he wasn't there, but the Court of Appeals apparently thought he was there. He voted no. And then you've got Commissioner Murray, who was no longer on the commission, who voted yes. We only had three commissioners. It was a 2-to-1 vote. You will have to invoke the rule of necessity, which Fitzgerald does say applies, you know, to these kinds of cases, and you'd have to go ahead and weigh it as an objective decision maker. I'm confident, given the facts of this case, you would affirm it. On the offer of proof,
are there any questions on the offer of proof?
Yes.
Go ahead. You may answer your question.
I didn't see the judge or anything in this record that distinguished between a written versus an oral offer of proof.
You're absolutely right. They didn't offer anything.
Are you saying that the regulatory judge would permit and the rules would not permit him to refuse a written offer of proof?
Well, the rules just gave the commission or him the discretion to say if it's wholly irrelevant, I don't need to take it. But there was no offer or
statement. But that's what the issue is before us. Can the rules do that constitutionally that they have a right to have us review it, and we can't review it if we can't see it?
Well, I mean, the Rorta case from the Eastern District and other cases, including the Environmental Utilities case, I'm not sure about this court, but I know that the other courts of appeals have said, you know, this is a constitutional statute.
Tell me why it's not inappropriate not to allow him. I can understand not taking time in the hearing, and the statute certainly allows that, but there's a difference between allowing cross-examination and so forth to go on things that the commissioner thinks are of marginal or no relevance versus not letting someone make a record for appeal.
Well, they never offered to make a record except the generic offer proof.
But what is your view of this? Could the court prohibit that if they did offer it?
Could
the regulatory judge have prohibited a written offer under this rule, or does it just apply to us?
I don't know that. I don't know if there's any case law on that. But it was never offered. Nobody said, well, I'd like to at least put the codes of conduct in, you know, in the record as an appellate exhibit for reviewing court to review. There was never any offer of that. And to the extent that they're saying the code of conduct relates to procurement issues and under the table money, we had procurement witnesses who testified that the director of procurement for one of the power plant projects was even released. So I think that the record is really inadequate to go beyond this, and I believe that what the regulatory law judge did is supported by the statute.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to briefly touch on the issue of the rule of necessity since it has come up.
Did you try to make a record on on what happened at this meeting?
Did
you make a record on the
judge? I think if you go back and you look at the motion to dismiss that I filed, which the commission denied, and then I filed an application for reconsideration of the commission's denial, both of those lay out, based on evidence in the record, what I could reconstruct happened in those meetings. The commission or the utilities, neither one has ever denied that reconstruction is inaccurate.
Right, but the part that you were denied the offer of proof on didn't include allegations about the bias or impropriety of the meetings. That's a separate issue.
That's an entirely separate issue. But with respect to the rule of necessity, it only applies in very limited situations, and there are two prerequisites for it. One is that the judge or judges are required to be disqualified, that they've got to be out. They can't try the case for whatever reason. And two, that there is no other tribunal that can actually hear the dispute. We really haven't fleshed out this issue because so far neither the commission nor any of the lower courts have found that the commissioners were to have been disqualified, and that's a prerequisite to actually getting to whether you apply the rule of necessity. And the second point as to whether or not there is another tribunal
who can disqualify them? I mean, is it something they have to disqualify themselves, or the commissioner has to do disqualification?
For example, the commissioners could have said at the very beginning, in response to my motion to dismiss, say, we're right, we think there is appearance of impropriety, but we're the only game in town. We have to decide this case, and so we're going to under the rule of necessity. But the thing about doing that is that there are consequences. If the rule of necessity is applied, then the judicial review takes a different path. Pursuant to the Barker case, 752 Southwest 2nd, 437, the Western District said, whenever the rule of necessity is invoked, the reviewing court should review with special intensity. And they said that in that case, their review was done with a more critical eye than is usual. So in a PSC review,
when we've applied rule of necessity, it may have been like judicial salary increases or retirement or it's a general kind of thing. Or in the IALTA case, well, we issued a rule and the lawyers said, well, sue us because they didn't think our rule was constitutional. It's not the same thing as I went on a hunting trip, which really wouldn't have any make any difference to me. But I went on a hunting trip with the proposal of the merger and had a good time and stuff, and that's a little different. Or other things like that. That's a little different from recusal.
And that's why I said you have to find a reason that the judge or tribunal should have been recused or disqualified before you even get to finding
the rule of necessity. Can you address Mr. Zobrist's argument that the final proposal that was approved is not the same one that was talked about in that January meeting 13 months earlier? So even assuming that was improper, it really shouldn't invalidate what occurred here.
And that I think gets to the distinction between actual bias and the appearance of impropriety. I don't think you can cure an appearance of impropriety that is created by these secret pre-filing meetings by saying, you know what, we're gonna frame the issues a little bit differently.
And you're saying we should basically infer an appearance of impropriety standard, even though the Code of Judicial Conduct doesn't directly apply because of the judicial capacity in which the commissioners are acting.
Yes. And I think some of the questions and some of the responses from the respondents seem to indicate that there is some sort of a bright line that up until the moment a case is filed, the commissioners are acting legislatively.
Well, doesn't the statute kind of suggest a bright line? It changes the rules, right?
The statute does suggest that there may be, that there are certain times that certain communications are allowed. It doesn't specifically say that up until the time a case is filed, you can preview the case and look for reactions. It doesn't go so far as to say that. It doesn't prohibit it, but it doesn't explicitly allow it either. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think the statute can be read to be applied in such a way that it violates due process.
Does the definition of person in the statute include utilities?
The definition of person is, first of all, person is defined in the statute and is defined very, very broadly to include corporations and natural persons and whatnot. But that's not the category that's in Section 386.210.1, which lays out members of the public, other conventions and other commissions.
So it uses the word members of the public rather than person.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's later in subsection 4 that they talk about persons, and I think that's not critical to what the issue we're talking about here. And if I can briefly talk about the offer of proof, I did personally say I would like to make an offer of proof. Judge, is it your ruling that an offer of proof is prohibited? I didn't say oral, written, cross-examination, and the judge said, yes, we will not have an offer of
proof
on this.
But what you first just tried to do was have someone testify. Right.
But to clarify that, I asked the judge, and this is the transcript decided in, I don't know if it's in Mr. Woods Hall's substitute brief, but it was certainly in my brief at the Western District, of the section of the transcript where I said, is it your ruling that we cannot make an offer of proof at all? And the judge's ruling was yes, that's the ruling.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case is taken under submission.